Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. And we're here till 5 a.m. It is Monday. And again, that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're here till 5. Steve Grzanich comes up at 5 with the opening bell, followed by the great Steve Cochran at 6. Today in history, federal prisoners first land at Alcatraz. We're going to talk about that and then bust into the essential and best prison movies of all time. There are a lot of great ones. We were also last Friday morning. We were talking about weird and crazy snacks that we used to eat in the 80s, and I want to get back to that. We didn't go through the whole thing, and that was a lot of fun to talk about those, so we're going to get to that as well. But it is Monday, and that means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Every week, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me to talk movie reviews, and we'll review all the movies, and then Eric sticks around because he writes a box office report every week, and we will we'll be talking about the numbers for the box office this weekend as well. That's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And all right, let's get the guys on. Here is Eric. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
All right, and here is Steve. Hey, Steve.
Hello.
All right. Well, we were off last Monday because Steve and I were at the Flashback weekend.
We were a little busy.
It was great, though, man. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, it was terrific.
Yeah, really great. Nice turnout for everybody. And, you know, very, very cool. Very, very cool stars showing up. And we had lots of fun, and I spent some money. I bought a John Carpenter hoodie.
With the names of the movies on the sleeves.
It's a badass. Best $50 I ever spent.
All the movies?
Not all of them.
Oh.
Well, which ones were you looking?
Cause no, I'm just wondering if there's if you're going to have a John Carpenter, it's like a complete filmography of John Carpenter's work.
Yeah, it's not all of them, but it's
so selective.
Good ones, Eric.
They're all good.
Okay,
but the sleeves are about. I don't have it with me right here, but I think there's eight titles on each sleeve or something like that. Seven or eight.
Is it
titles
like End of They Live or
They Live is there? They Live is on there.
In the Mouth of Madness.
In the Mouth of Madness is on there.
Okay.
Yeah. The Ward, oddly enough, not on there.
Well,
I like that movie. I don't care.
I know it's not terrible.
Yeah. Well, it's also good. So, but then there's this great montage of pictures on the back that's shaped like his head, and then on the front,
sure.
In the front, there's a Michael Myers is on the front, and it just says it's a quote from Carpenter that says, "Horror films will live forever, John Carpenter."
Okay,
yeah. So I'm digging that, and so anyway, but it was fun, Steve. We kept busy all weekend, and
good grief, did we? Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And there were lots of people there, and it was as busy as it normally is. But lots of fun, and of course my favorite part of the weekend though was the Svengoolie thing,
the
40th anniversary of Svengoolie celebration, which was just fantastic, and Rich being there for two nights, and then we had a big party for him at the VIP party with a cake shaped like his head, which was fantastic. So it was a fun weekend, but we missed last week. And now I did not. And Eric, I understand that you didn't see Hobbs and Nobbs either.
Hobbs and Nobbs, no,
yeah.
I did not.
But Steve, you saw Hobbs and Shaw.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's play a little catch up here.
Am I the only one that saw it?
Yeah, I didn't see it.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's unusual. By the way, it's unusual for me. It's unusual for me not to see a Fast and Furious movie because I happen to be fans of that series. So
yeah, and I'm not. So.
Yeah. Okay.
It evens out.
What do you got there, Steve? What do you think?
So it's no secret that the Fast and Furious films, and I think there have been eight up to this point, get sort of bigger and dumber as the numbers get higher. But apparently there are so many cast members now that they have to start spinning off characters into their own movies, and the first of these is Hobbs and Shaw. This one follows arguably the two biggest actors in the franchise, and yes, I'm including Vin Diesel. Both of whom were sort of latecomers to the series, who were sort of brought in to add a little star power and a little shock and awe to the series. In the case of both of them, I believe they were introduced as characters who were adversaries at first, and then they sort of had to eventually pair up with Vin Diesel's family, in quotes, to fight an even greater threat, whoever that might be. So, you know, Hobbs and Shaw seem to hate each other with a particular flair, so it only makes sense that they get a spinoff where they're forced to work together again and save the world. Hobbs is recruited by the CIA to track down a supposedly rogue MI6 agent named Hattie, who's played by Vanessa Kirby. I didn't even say the two characters, Hobbs and Shaw, played by Dwayne Johnson and Jason Statham, of course. For those of you living under a rock. So apparently this Hattie character has reportedly killed every member of her team that was sent in to recover a deadly virus that kills a person in a matter of a few days. And why would anyone invent a virus like that? I don't know. But then ends up stealing the virus and injecting these sort of microscopic capsules into her own body in order to get away with it. In truth, Hattie has actually injected herself to keep the virus away from a cyber genetically enhanced bad guy named Brixton, who's played by Idris Elba, who declares himself the Black Superman because he's basically indestructible and he's almost like the $6 billion man. So he has a lot of computers in him and enhancements. What we eventually find out is that Hattie is actually Shaw's estranged sister, and Brixton is a former spy who worked closely with Shaw until he attempted to turn him, at which place Shaw plugged him with enough bullets that he thought would kill him, and he was obviously wrong. There's like a 72-hour time limit, basically, with this virus that seems like a completely arbitrary number designed to give no other purpose than to give the movie a countdown clock. But eventually, Hattie's body is going to... all the organs are going to dissolve in her body, and she'll basically become a virus bomb contaminating potentially millions. So Hobbs and Shaw kind of come together, not knowingly at first, and of course they fight. And the cool thing about Kirby's character is that she, you know, kicks as much ass as her male counterparts by also kind of calling out these two knuckleheads on their posturing and their inability to sort of put humanity before their petty beef. So eventually, when everyone gets that out of their system, they become a pretty interesting threesome, and the Shaws have a slightly more refined approach, and Hobbs basically just punches first and asks questions later. So the film is directed by David Leitch, the former stuntman and stunt coordinator who made Atomic Blonde. He made Deadpool 2, and I think Hobbs and Shaw kind of shares some qualities, both good and bad, with those movies, which is that when the film focuses on the action, it's kind of unstoppable. When it's just about like zingers and dumb jokes and posturing, it just gets really boring and old really fast. And, you know, if all you want is to hear The Rock and The Transporter fight over whose faces look more like a scrotum, then you're probably in for the ride of your life. But, you know, like, a few of these jokes, and honestly, some of the jokes do hit a little harder, and it feels like a little bit of a roast, and those jokes are a little meaner, and they're really funny, but that's there's not enough of those. So the bigger problem I had is that a lot of the action sequences also look really CGI created and really fake. And I think it's weird that in this franchise where, you know, I realize they've been doing CGI car chases for a while, but to a certain degree they've also kind of held fast to the idea, use practical effects whenever they can. And this film kind of abandons that almost entirely, except for kind of a cool sequence at the end when Brixton's forces are kind of fighting an army of Samoans, most of whom are Hobbs' extended family members, who are fighting with like spears and clubs and other more traditional weapons. And there's a sequence where there are like five cars linked together to keep a helicopter from like taking off, and I'm sure it is fake, but it looks real and it looks sort of homegrown, and I love that sequence. It's pretty great. But beyond that, there are a few surprises, including some really weird extended kind of jarring cameos by some pretty big actors, and also some of the most unnecessary mid and post credit sequences in the history of this franchise. You know, there's car chases, motorcycle chases, a whole lot of explosions, and some interesting supporting work by people like Eddie Marsden and Cliff Curtis, and of course, Helen Mirren as the Shaw matriarch, still in jail. But it's a passable placeholder, I guess, till next year's official ninth Fast and Furious movie, but I don't think I'd revisit this one. There's a certain energy to it that I dug, but it doesn't I don't know. It's not the same as the main franchise. The dynamic of between the characters is different, obviously. And I honestly, unless these guys grow up just a little bit more the next time around, assuming they do another one, I'm probably going to lose interest in this series pretty quickly.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. Hobbs and Shaw, number one at the box office again. We'll get to the numbers a little bit later on, but that's out right now. We were off last week, so we missed reviewing it. Nothing else really opened last week, right? That was the only...
That was the big wide release.
The big one, yeah.
There's a few independent things open, but that was the big one.
Okay. And it's doing... How is it... I mean, in terms of box office, is it doing as well as the other Fast and Furious movies? Or?
Not really. No, not at all, actually. I mean, it looks like it's probably going to be probably more in line with actually the fourth Fast and Furious movie, which is only about $150 million.
Hmm.
It's been about 330-something worldwide right now, but yeah. Once Diesel came back to the series and Walker and they cleared them up again, like they haven't had one that's grossed less than like $600 million, is insane just thinking about that.
Yeah.
But this one with the two bigger stars, Diesel says is probably having a pretty good laugh right now.
Yeah, probably. Probably. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Steve are here. They review the movies with me, Monday morning movie reviews. We had to play catch up, but we were off last Monday morning, so we're back, and now we'll review all the new movies, and we'll do box office as well right after we take a break for the news right here on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. The anniversary of Prisoner's first landing at Alcatraz is today, so we're going to bust out some of the great prison movies of all time. And our phone lines and text lines are open at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. So where we go. Let's get back to it. It's the Monday morning movie review. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every week to review the new movies. And we played a little catch-up from last week with Steve telling us about Hobbs and Shaw. But now we got new movies to talk about. Let's bring the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Eric, looks like you're the only one that saw The Art of Racing in the Rain.
Yeah.
Let's hear about this one.
Okay. Well, this movie stars Kevin Costner, or more appropriately, the voice of Kevin Costner, as we hear him as the voice of Enzo the dog. Enzo the dog is snapped up at a very young age by a race car driver played by Milo Ventimiglia, and is basically the story of this guy's life, or more importantly, this dog's life, as he becomes man. This guy's best friend, and we get to hear every inner thought the dog talks about, and it's a pretty deep thinking dog. He's got he gets to watch a lot of TV, and he talks about a Mongolian documentary that he saw that talks about the spiritual afterlife of dogs. It's very deep stuff going on in this dog's head. While also, requisite poop jokes and things like that along the way as we go through this guy's life. The Art of the Racing in the Rain refers to the Milo's character as a race car driver who is sort of an expert of navigating through the raindrops, and this sort of and that becomes a metaphor for life, as you will. He meets a young woman played by Amanda Seyfried. They get married. They have a child. All the complications as we go through the entire span of the dog's life. Okay. So when I saw this trailer, I think for the first time, I think in front of Stuber last month, and I sat there watching this thing, and I sat there watching it and thinking, I don't know if I can sit through this movie. even though I am a sucker for dog movies, and they just so many of them just instantly just get to my soft spots. I just watching this this trailer, going, they're going to kill this dog. this is Marley. This is the studio that brought us Marley and Me, and they're going to kill this dog by the end of the movie. The first scene of the movie is the dog basically on his last legs.
Oh, God.
I almost walked out immediately because I didn't know if I could handle it. I'm like, no, the dog seems to have something to say. I want to hear what the dog's got to say. Okay, so the first part of this movie, I actually think isn't too bad. I actually, you know, it does kind of feel like an audiobook that we're listening to, because so much of it is Kevin Costner narrating the thing, and he's got this deep, gravelly voice. This is not like, you know, Harrison Ford in Secret Life of Pets 2. He's got like these really sort of deep philosophical thoughts and stuff, all, you know, through a dog's perspective. I'm like, okay, well, this is kind of an interesting way to do a movie like this. And I'm kind of down with this. The human characters are not particularly that interesting, but, you know, seeing them through the dog's eyes, maybe we're going to get to a little bit more interesting talks about spirituality and, you know, all these kind of lofty things that we hope might be in the movie. But this movie just kind of slowly devolves into just one tragedy after another, to the point that it just feels like you can't even bear it anymore. You're sitting there and just like, literally nothing good happens in this movie once it sort of gets going. Yes, there is a marriage. Yes, there is a child. Yes, there are brief moments of happiness and stuff, but there's a lot of foreshadowing going on that things, you know, starting with the opening scene, that things are not going to turn out great for some of these characters. And it begins to just feel like this weight is just an anvil, is just being pressed on your chest. And I've come to know the difference when a movie is getting inside, you know, my sort of spiritual inbox and really trying to navigate and pull, you know, earn tears naturally, and something that is only designed as a tear-making machine. And that's what this thing feels like, because at some point the lofty dog narration kind of gets thrown in the background a little bit, because the tragedy stuff really starts to take hold. And it gets to the point where, like, the third act of the movie is basically the entire season of Big Little Lies Season 2, which is just completely out of left field and completely just unnecessary. And then it's all leading up to everything you think is going to happen in the first scene. So, I mean, I'm not really giving any spoilers here, but I couldn't believe watching this thing that they couldn't find something more interesting to say with the story. I mean, the talking through the dog's eyes and ears, and, you know, getting up to where, you know, he's just pooping on the floor and, you know, sitting in his own pee and stuff. It's an unpleasant experience, and apparently the book is even more unpleasant because there's even a false rape accusation in the book. This is a movie that I wish I could have liked a lot more than I did, but it's a tear making factory and an insincere one at the best.
Okay, all right, so that's The Art of Racing in the Rain. Okay, I've kind of had it with dog talking dog movies. I think I've reached my limit for these things.
Well, they do more than cats.
Yeah. Okay. All right. All right, Steve. I believe you're the only one that saw Brian Banks.
Yes.
So let's hear about that one.
Speaking of fake rape allegations, far too often significant true life stories kind of get ruined by attempting to dramatize them or make them more cinematic. Certainly the story of NFL player Brian Banks is an important one, and it's important to tell for many reasons, but it's really easy in this version of his story to get lost in sort of self-righteous nobility and almost like I don't know. It's too polished a lot throughout the whole thing, and we're constantly, things are getting underscored by very important writing and acting and speechifying. As played by Aldis Hodge, who was MC Ren and Straight Outta Compton, Banks was a high school football player, a superstar, really, all-star, on the verge of heading to USC and to begin what would likely become a successful run into pro ball. When a fellow student falsely accuses him of rape, his football career is not only derailed, but he lands up in prison or on probation for like a total of about 10 years. In an attempt to get his life back and make it possible for him to even just get a job, let alone get back into football, he contacts the California Innocence Project, which is led by Justin Brooks, who's played here by Greg Kinnear. The group is hesitant to help him because their primary mission is to get innocent prisoners with long sentences, life sentences or death sentences, out of jail. But Banks pleads with them to sort of help him reclaim a life that was sort of callously tossed away by a crippled justice system. And so that begins the long, sort of time-consuming task of clearing his name. Tom Shadyac directed this, who I'm sure many of you know, directed the first Ace Ventura movie, The Nutty Professor, Bruce and Evan Almighty. But lately he's been on sort of this do-gooder trip. And for anyone who saw his documentary, I Am, this is sort of a continuation of that vibe, and that's not a good thing in my eyes. He removes basically every ounce of subtlety from the story, most importantly making absolutely sure, almost from the first frame, that there is never a doubt in our minds that Banks is innocent from the second we meet him. He sort of eliminates that even dramatic possibility that something may have actually happened in this rape sequence, but he kind of demonizes the woman who accuses him, as well as her mother, and because they both got a big payday from the school district because of this event. There are some very bizarre details in his story, which I assume are true, including the fact that his accuser reached out to him on Facebook after he got out of jail, which resulted in getting an actual filmed confession by her admitting that she lied, but somehow that's still inadmissible in court. So there's plenty of room here to get like actually outraged by the way the justice system works, at least in California. But outside of some of these more interesting details, the film offers very few surprises or moments of reflection or insight into the legal process. So it sort of just defeats the whole purpose of the movie. We assume things are going to turn out a certain way for Banks because we're watching a movie about it. So even that dramatic tension is sort of taken out of the equation. Honestly, it's weird watching a movie today where we are basically told from the first frame, do not believe the victim. That's a weird feeling to sit through for a whole 2-hour movie. Mm-hmm. So even though, like, again, it's clear, it's never in doubt, it's obviously what happened. Greg Kinnear is here. Greg Kinnear is Greg Kinnear, and that's about it, all that implies. He's clearly supposed to be like the nice guy, but it feels like he's just doing a little bit of coasting here. Brian Banks, the film feels like a sort of worthy, maybe made for cable endeavor, but there's nothing about this big screen telling that makes it seem like something you should spend your money on. So,
okay. All right, there you go. Yeah. That's Brian Banks. All right, guys, hang on. We got a break here. Eric and Steve are here. When we come back, we got more movies to review right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude. 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning, and that's what we do. It's also Monday morning movie reviews. Let's get back to them. More movies to talk about. We'll also talk about the weekend box office with our buddy Eric. So Eric and Steve are here, and let's welcome them back. Eric, welcome back. And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, guys. All right, Eric, this is you tell us about you're the only one that saw it, Light of My Life, which is Casey Affleck's latest film.
Yeah.
Hold on, Steve.
Yeah.
Steve, you saw it?
I did.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sorry. Well, Eric, you start.
Okay. As I was saying, I think Casey Affleck's last directorial effort is still under Nick Hsu somewhere. The I'm Still Here, the Joaquin Phoenix wannabe rap artist documentary.
It's hard for me to measure how much I hate that movie.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Okay.
And you're not wrong. But this film is a total 180 departure from that film. For one, it is a narrative, and not just written and directed by Casey Affleck, but he also stars in the movie. And this is basically a post-apocalyptic drama where Casey Affleck is one of a large handful of survivors, and his young daughter, I think she's like 12, maybe 13 years old in the film, played by Anna Ponyansky. Basically it's a apocalyptic world where some sort of virus or plague has basically wiped the world clean of women, with the exception of his daughter, who appears to be immune. She was born right at the time that this plague was starting to take effect. So they wander through the world, looking for supplies, trying to keep each other alive, telling stories to one another. The film kind of opens with a really sort of brilliant opening scene where Casey Affleck tells the story to his daughter, a story about Noah's Ark, and he makes up a lot of details, and it's kind of a geared towards a kid's story, but it's this sort of remarkable moment where he says that the story is going to be about a female character and ends up being about a male character, and it really kind of sets the tone for this film, which follows the apocalyptic template, if you will. The things that happen to them along the way are not completely out of place from other apocalyptic movies that we've seen, but he does have to pass off his young daughter as a boy to prevent her from any potential harm or anyone possibly looking to repopulate. So there's a lot of tension there as well. And I think that this is a pretty solid piece of work from him. I think that when this movie just kind of popped up on the radar, it seemed like just a few weeks ago. I didn't even know it was coming out this soon. And there was some blowback because people who know Casey Affleck, speaking of I'm Still Here, had some issues, some accusations on the set of that film. And some people thought it might cost him the Oscar for Manchester by the Sea. It didn't. But these sort of accusations have sort of plagued him, whatnot, sort of, no pun intended. And the thought of him doing a movie where some virus has wiped out women from the world, whether this is going to be his sort of either revenge fantasy or his sort of apology tour. And I don't think, this movie certainly doesn't go to the former. And I think it's kind of unfair to even look at it as the latter, because this is a pretty thoughtful piece of work. I think he's very good in the film. The young girl is also quite good. Like I said, there's a pretty solid amount of tension throughout the film, and mostly it's just the two of them together, and the way that they talk to each other, and the way that they tell these stories, and he's trying to be the best dad possible. I should also mention that there's actually flashbacks to just before the plague, and his wife is played by Elizabeth Moss in the flashback scenes. And so this movie is kind of it's sort of like The Road meets Children of Men. I think it's much better than the former, not quite up to the standards of the latter. But Affleck's work here is very strong, both in front and behind the camera. I think it's a pretty worthy piece of work, and it's playing with facets right now. I got to see it on a screener, but I think that if, you know, people have the opportunity to see it on a big screen of facets, they should take the opportunity. I like the movie.
Okay, that's Light of My Life, which is at facets right now. All right, let's start off with Steve. Why don't you tell us? And I didn't see Dora.
Wait. Do you want me to talk about that?
Oh, wait, Steve, one? I'm sorry. I forgot. Because on my cheat sheet, it's just Eric's name. So, Steve, go ahead. Okay. Light of My Life. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to add that, I liked it quite a bit, actually. And I was a little less concerned going in about the whole wiping out most women from the planet thing, because I think Casey Affleck's a little smarter than that. It's a very conversation-heavy piece. It's sort of an atmospheric thriller. But there are, like, definite undertones of, like, oppression and alienation and exclusion of women that are almost more about when they were all alive than in the current situation that he's living through with his daughter. There's a really great sequence, lengthy and quite moving conversation between the father and daughter about a basic birds and the bees conversation that is sort of funny, but also sort of beautiful and necessary and very moving that I liked. The conversation is actually part of my favorite part of the film, because it's so unlike what is essentially, I mean, it's a science fiction film technically, but it doesn't really feel like one. But he is, Casey Affleck, let's face it, he's worked with and learned from the best over his career, and I think he's created a film that's very much his own. And he's sort of just added, I think with this film at least, he's added sort of another thing that he's very good at. So I'm looking forward to what he's going to do from this point forward as a director.
Okay. All right, so that's Light of My Life. Both positive reviews from Steve and Eric. All right, Steve, tell us a little bit about Dora and the Lost City of Gold.
You know you want to know about it.
Oh, come on now.
Okay, I'll tell you why. So like 10 or more years ago, I used to babysit for my friend's kids, and so I got like healthy doses of Dora the Explorer, the cartoon. And it's a bizarre show. So when I heard that there was going to be a live-action version of this show about this young girl who kind of spends her life exploring for treasure and other sort of hidden curiosities, I was both intrigued and a little shocked at how they were going to handle it, because the way she addresses the camera a lot of times is I don't know how that would translate. She's got this pet monkey. She's got an adversary that's a fox named Swiper who steals everything she tries to get. But I'm like, again, how are you going to turn that into a live action thing? And so what they've done is they sort of aged her up. They put her in high school. They took her out of the jungle. I mean, we see it happen. They took her out of the jungle. We get a little intro piece where we see her as the age she's supposed to be in the cartoon. And it's kind of funny because she's, again, talking to the camera, and her parents are there with her, and they're looking like, who are you talking to? Like, what is going on here? And her parents are played by Michael Pena and Eva Longoria. So she goes to high school, and it's sort of a different kind of adventure for her. She doesn't seem quite as she doesn't seem to care the way some high school kids do about fitting in. She kind of sticks to her guns and is true to herself. And this cousin of hers that she grew up with named Diego, who's played as an older kid by Jeff Wahlberg, who I think is Mark Wahlberg's nephew, he's a little embarrassed of her now because she's sort of so colorful. And what's sort of interesting about the film is that, and what I didn't know even going into it, was that, and it's a reason I think to sort of give it a second thought, is that it's brought to us by the director and one of the writers of the guys who did the Muppets, who brought the Muppets back to the movies. James Bobbin and Nicholas Stoller are kind of behind this thing, and they have a knowingness about what's weird about Dora, and they address it, and it makes it sort of funny. It's still sort of very kid-friendly Indiana Jones sort of adventures, but I think a lot of it works, and I think, you know, there's stuff here for adults, there's stuff here for kids. It's certainly not next level action movie or comedy or anything like that, but it gets the job done. And the lead actress, Isabella Moner, who has been in a run of big films, like she was in Instant, was the older kid in Instant Family. She was in the Sicario sequel. I think she was in the last non-Bumblebee Transformers movie. She's fantastic in this, and just like really knowing and funny and high energy and endearing, and she kind of captures just enough of young Dora's persona to make her recognizable while still sort of showing us the ways that Dora is sort of making adjustments to this new adventure as a teenager. So there's some, you know, there's a few, again, cameos thrown in. I know your favorite actor, Nick, Eugenio Derbez, is in this.
God.
As another explorer who sort of helps Dora and her friends look for this lost city of gold, where her parents are. But then there's also like the talking fox who steals things is voiced by Benicio del Toro, who sounds like he's having like a straight up ridiculous time playing this insane fox. And yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's not gonna set any records. It's not gonna like be a benchmark in children's entertainment, but it's a nice sort of combination of nostalgia and a little throwback to a more innocent time in certainly Dora's life, so and mine too. So
okay, all right,
a mild recommendation.
Okay, there you go. All right, Eric, we'll hear what you think of it after we break. Okay. All right, Eric Childress and Steve Procopi here reviewing the new movies. When we come back, we'll hear what Eric thought of Dora and the Lost City of Gold right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we're here until 5 a.m. The Monday morning movie reviews are happening right now on this Monday morning, and also my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, as we do every Monday morning. Before the break, Steve told us that he kind of liked Dora and the Lost City of Gold, so let's find out what Eric thought of it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Eric, what did you think?
I liked it, too. Yeah, I'm going to double down on a lot of the things that that Steve said, and you know, I don't think I have the healthy dose of Dora experience that Steve has, but I do have nieces and I do have friends with daughters, so I've seen my share of the cartoon over the years. And what I liked so much about this movie is actually the balance that Boban and Stoller bring to it. And by that I mean that, like Steve said, they kind of address they have the character of Dora and her quirks and the things she does talking to the camera and some of the sprightly, ridiculous things that she does at times. And they address that without like going like full Brady Bunch movie on it and just making a whole mockery of it. They actually treat her as a very sincere character who's just a bit out of place. And she's, you know, a lot smarter than a lot of the kids in the high school. And I also like the fact that it doesn't just turn into this full-on goofy fish-out-of-water thing. Exactly. They take her from the jungle, they put her in high school for a little bit, but then they bring them right back into the jungle with some friends of theirs. So it becomes more of a fish-out-of-water story for them than for Dora, and they put her right back in her element. And then it's just kind of a pleasant family adventure. You know, for one that has actually, I would say, an original quicksand scene where I actually learned something about how to deal with quicksand. Little moments like that. You know, surely this movie, you know, Stoller and Boban have, they've seen Goonies. They've certainly seen Indiana Jones' Last Crusade. You know, they ape a few things here and there. And that's probably for the adults in the audience who grew up with those types of movies. Yeah, I'm with you, Nick. I mean, there's almost no movie that Eugenio Debes can show up in that doesn't grind it to a halt every time he tries to be funny.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the case here for the most part. But Isabel Molnar's is just so winning in this role. I mean, when she looks at the camera, she has this smile that just kind of lights up the theater in it. She's just kind of joyful, and she's such a pleasant character to be around, and just you root for her in the film. And like you said, Benicio del Toro's having fun. Everyone seems to be having a good time. And unlike some other films that I've seen recently, the supporting characters, with the exception of Derbez, are not annoying. Michael Pena, is having a lot of fun in this movie. And yeah, so I had a very pleasant time. I smiled quite a bit throughout this movie, and I hope families go see it.
Okay. And we'll talk about the box office that it did over the weekend, but it's nice to see that there's, a pretty decent, family adventure movie out there right now, which is pretty cool. All right, Eric, tell us about The Kitchen.
Okay. Well, this is actually based on a DC graphic novel. Or comic book for people, and it's set in 1978 in Hell's Kitchen. Three wives of three criminals who are involved in the extortion racket, played by Melissa McCarthy, Tiffany Haddish, and Elizabeth Moss. Their husbands are not great people. They put them down, they beat them, they ignore them. It's sort of like each one gets their own trait, but they go to jail pretty quickly after trying to pull a robbery for some fast cash to help them out, and they're standing in the racket or however that's explained. So when they go to jail, and the Irish mob really doesn't take care of them past one payday, they decide to basically pick up where their husbands left off and take the extortion racket and form it for themselves, and they do it pretty quickly in the movie. In 20 minutes in this film, they have already basically taken over the entire Irish mob without anyone seemingly noticing, the movie then sort of traces their rise to power and how power corrupts and all those sorts of things. Okay, so I mentioned this movie is based on a comic book or a graphic novel, and watching this movie and how shabbily it is put together, it's kind of like reading in comic books. You have, there are great comic books, there are great graphic novels that can tell a complete story and do it wonderfully through visuals and through dialogue and all kinds of things. But this one feels like one of these comic books where it just gives you enough of what's going on. It puts a word balloon up here and there, and you just kind of fast forward through it and speed read it to get to the more interesting parts. The problem is that this movie doesn't really have any interesting parts, but it's paced like you're sitting there keeping looking for them. With the exception of Elizabeth Moss and Domhnall Gleeson, who plays one of the racket's hitmen. Aside from those two characters, there's literally not a single interesting character in this entire movie, which is really kind of shocking how, because it has such a great cast to it. McCarthy and Haddish are given so little to do. And I think part of the problem is that the director of the movie, Andrea Berloff, doesn't seem to know if she's making a comedy or a drama. There are bits in the movie where it seemed like McCarthy is somewhere in between the put upon housewife that she's played for so long, who then finds her strength in her voice and her mouth, and then trapped between that and her can you ever forgive me character. And it just, there's an unbalance to both her performance and Haddish's performance that is just so, just kind of off-putting. And it's just like, well, which direction? Are we supposed to be laughing at this? Or are we supposed to be terrified? So all those things are going on. And Elizabeth Moss just kind of is the third wheel in all of this. And so her character, who has the probably the best semblance of an arc in a movie, is just feels like she's just being shoved aside, and the closure to that whole storyline just feels rushed and unsatisfying. The Domhnall Gleeson character shows up out of nowhere, but at least that's something that happens in this movie, which is just like I said, the whole movie feels like it's on fast forward, trying to get to what is kind of modulating what exactly the tone of this movie is supposed to be. And then it leads up to this, like, Kaiser Soze, like, twist that is then never mentioned again. It's such an odd beast of a movie, and it's boring on top of it. This is really one of the most shockingly worst films of the year. I think with the exception of Men in Black International, it's one of the sloppiest films I have seen all year.
Yeah, it's a mess, man. it's a real mess. And, I like all three, women in this movie, and I think they're all really great, especially, I mean, obviously, I love Elizabeth Moss, and she's the best thing in the film, I think.
She is.
Agreed.
Yeah, and she's the best thing in... Oh, Steve, you saw it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, because I only had Eric's name down on this one,
maybe
too.
Maybe you didn't get the new update.
I guess maybe I didn't. Okay.
I did either, so...
I'll finish my review real quick, Steven.
We'll
get you in.
Okay. Yeah,
no, I was real disappointed with this movie. I was really looking forward to it because I really like the lead, and I like the idea of, a mob movie led by women. I also love the fact... I love that time period, especially in New York. And I think they do. I mean, I'll give you this. The production design, the costumes are great. They did a really nice job dirtying up Hell's Kitchen and making it look like 70s New York. Not quite as good as The Deuce on HBO, but...
No, I thought of that show the entire time.
Well, as soon as they were in Times Square and she was walking across the street and all the marquees and the hookers, and I'm like, yeah, this isn't as good as The Deuce. But there's really nothing here. I didn't care about anything. I think maybe Elizabeth Moss is the only character that I had any kind of... and I liked her love interest in it. I thought that's the most interesting angle of the movie, and the only time it ever like really pops off the screen with any kind of emotion at all. It's really poorly assembled movie. Like, it hops around all over the place, and it has no sense of pace whatsoever. Melissa McCarthy, I think going through the motions here, as most people in this movie are. Some things were played for laughs, some things weren't, but there was never a sense of suspense. The whole handling of the husband angle seemed really weird, especially the relationship between Melissa McCarthy and her, the character the actor who played her husband. I guess that's what's supposed to be the emotional core of the movie. And there's supposed to be this like massive sort of payoff, near the end regarding his character that doesn't work. And yeah, the whole here's a surprise twist that nobody saw coming. And it makes no sense. Like, I was like, what? Because I was just sitting there going, I don't understand what's happening right now. And, you didn't mention Common, who basically... Common basically sits in a car or a van throughout the entire movie.
He's literally the worst police officer I've ever seen.
Yeah, both of the cops and the FBI guys are morons.
Right.
And there's no suspense. And like I said, the only kind of arc that I cared about at all was Elizabeth Moss. And I think 90% of that is because she's Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah.
And that's what she brings to the table, but outside of, like I said, outside of like the production design, the music's good too, like the use of music. But again, this has everything to do with the fact that it takes place in 78 and 79, which are really fun times for music and fun times to look at how crappy New York City was at that time.
But it also seemed like the filmmaker just saw other movies about the 70s and like, oh, those are the songs I'm going to use.
Yeah. No. That's exactly how the whole thing feels. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh, we're making a 70s movie. Let's really show everybody that we are making a 70s movie.
Yeah. Here's The Chain. We haven't heard that in any movies recently.
Right. And there's, hey, why didn't you get me Schlitz? There's the big art. She brings home High Life. Why didn't you get me Schlitz? I like Schlitz. And they're drinking they're drinking red wine out of that decanter, which is so 70s. I can't remember the brand, but it's not a clear bottle. It's like a red bottle, and that's what they're drinking the wine out of. And that was like a full-on 70s cheap, you know, rot gut wine that people were drinking back then. But I mean, so like the details are kind of fun to watch in the background, but nothing. None of the mob guys are interesting at all. So I don't know. Steve, hang on. Okay. We'll find out what you thought of it right after we break here.
Yep.
Eric and Steve, I didn't like The Kitchen. I was very disappointed in it, and Eric didn't like it. We'll find out what Steve thought of it right after we break. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call and tell a joke. We'll also talk box office, and we'll finish up the movie reviews. Before the break, Eric and I both disliked The Kitchen. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Steve, what'd you think?
I agree mostly. I will say though that I didn't find the Elizabeth Moss Domhnall Gleeson thing interesting just because it was them. I actually found it the only interesting thing in this movie, and I think like I would literally have loved to watch a movie about this woman who has spent not just her marriage but most of her life being abused in one way or another, actually like turn the tables and become like a full on assassin. After meeting this guy and sort of falling for him, or at least falling for like the danger and unpredictability of him. I love that story. And unfortunately that's not the focus of this movie. It's just one mobster cliche after another. And, I found, you know, Eric knows my deep, deep love of all things Margot Martindale. And when you can't use her in an interesting way, especially in a role like this, you've got real issues. And that was sort of my gauge for this movie. I did kind of dig what Bill Camp was doing in this as the Italian mobster who McCarthy kind of teams up with to a certain degree in some racket or another. I think he's manipulating things in a way that I don't even know if she's completely aware of, but I kind of loved his approach to that character. But again, not in it very much, so can't really hang your hook on that. But anyway, yeah, it's a bust. It's a total bust.
It is.
Can you guys think of any other movie that is pro extortion?
Yeah. You know, it's really, I will say this, I've kind of had my limit on watching Elizabeth Moss be abused. I just, because it's almost every movie she's in.
Else or herself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, her smell, she's abusing herself through the entire movie. All right, well, there you go. Three bad reviews for The Kitchen. All right, Steve, what is Loose?
I did not see Loose.
Oh, okay.
You definitely didn't get my new one because I took that one off.
Okay. What about Eric? You've seen it?
Eric? Yeah, I have seen it.
All right, well, let's hear about it.
Okay, well, this movie premiered at Sundance, and it was so good it played the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which is actually where I saw it. The movie stars Naomi Watts and Tim Roth as a couple of parents who basically become the guardians of who was a child soldier at one time, played by Kelvin Harrison Jr. Obviously is much younger. He's now a teenager and he's in high school. Very smart, confident, just sort of the light of their life in a way. He seems to be doing everything right. Octavia Spencer plays a teacher at the high school, who begins to see patterns in him that suggest that his behavior might not be entirely on the up and up. Things that he has said in class, said to her, his sort of thoughts on particular, murderous, people throughout history and characters in literature and stuff. And so she's a bit concerned and reaches out to the parents to let them know about this. They're not exactly certain that this teacher has their son's best interests at heart, and maybe because of personal things in her life, may also be trying to sort of manipulate the way in her sort of skewed view of history, suggesting that, you know, this boy is going to be something that sort of fits in with, again, her view of history more than the path that he has been placed on because of the environment that he now finds himself in. But the movie goes along, it becomes a sort of this dance between mostly the Naomi Watts mother character, Spencer's teacher, and the boys. We sort of follow these characters and how they are trying to pinpoint exactly what this guy is up to. If he's up to anything, is it something a little bit more imagined in Spencer's psyche or not? And it goes to some very really interesting places, really interesting ideas about racism and profiling and things. It's a pretty tense movie, even though it's mostly just a lot of people talking and arguing and just trying to, again, to try to sort of piece together exactly who is on the up and up amongst all these characters, and how far someone is willing to go to protect their child, whether or not they're on the up and up or not. This is a really strong screenplay. I think one of the best screenplays of the year. It's been a few months now since I've seen it, but I'm very much looking forward to seeing it again and seeing how it goes down a second time now that I'm aware of exactly, sort of all of its secrets and everything. Because there's some really chilling stuff happening in this movie to keep you on edge. And I think that, especially, everything that that goes on in this country about race, I think this is a real conversation starter. Not just great performances by Watson Roth. Octavia Spencer is really good here, and Kelvin Harrison Jr. is fantastic in this movie. This guy has been, been in movies the last couple of years. He's really been doing it. This is his best work to date. It's certainly one of Spencer's best roles to date. This is a really strong film that I'm very much looking forward to revisiting during awards time.
Okay. All right, there you go. That's Loose, and it's playing at a few theaters here in the city and around, so make sure you check it out. All right, Steve, tell us about Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Gladly. Before you get completely bent out of the shape about the fact that this latest horror offering from producer, and he's also given a screen story credit, Guillermo del Toro, is rated PG-13, take into consideration that the original Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark book series, which was three books over about 10 years, beginning in 1981, I believe. The series was made for kids, sort of an entry level into horror. Not in the same way that sort of Goosebumps was. It was a little more advanced than that, and certainly with the artwork that was in it, even more so. But also keep in mind that there have been some very scary and effective PG-13 horror films over the years, including A Quiet Place from last year, for example.
Yeah.
So many examples. The series of books was written by the late Alvin Schwartz, and it was sort of a play off the act of presenting terrifying tales in a group setting. The books were meant to be read out loud, and the book even had suggestions for the reader, the person actually doing the reading, of like scary things they could do while they were reading it to freak out the people they were reading to. So rather than bring sort of the individual stories of those books into sort of an anthology work, the filmmakers have made the stories themselves be the sort of bringer of menace and even death in this story set in 1968 at the height of both the Vietnam War and then also the brink of Richard Nixon being reelected. And it's not a coincidence at all that horror is being presented on two fronts in this film, one in the supernatural world, and then one in the political world, specifically the threat of being drafted into the military is a thing that comes up over and over again here. These three small-town teenage best friends decide to celebrate Halloween in various ways, including by hitting the local scary house, haunted house, where the legend has it that a young woman named Sarah Bellows died, maybe at her own hand, and she may still haunt the place. When they're in the house, the kids find a sort of secret room where Sarah's parents locked her away. And in there, they discover a book of these handwritten stories by Sarah, each one featuring very disgusting stories in a lot of cases, with the names of her family members mentioned as the victims of these horrible, presumably fictional scenarios, although it turns out all those people actually did die in horrible ways in real life. So they take the book with them, and before long, news stories start appearing on the pages in fresh red ink that might be blood, and even worse, as they're being written into the book by this sort of invisible hand, the events that are being described begin to happen in real life to people that these kids know. These stories have weird titles like Harold and the Big Toe and the Red Spot, and the kids sort of have to figure out why it's happening and what they could do to stop it before anyone in their little circle of friends becomes the next victim. So there's a mystery around Sarah Bellow's life and death, and that sort of factors into the way they have to stop this from happening. Each of the stories features a really grotesque creature of some sort, the designs of which seem definitely to have been taken from the books and the original artwork by Stephen Gammell, which was later replaced because some people thought the artwork was too intense. But watching these sort of hideous things move and make all these disgusting noises as they sort of jerk and twist around in inhuman ways sort of pushes certain boundaries in this supposedly kid-friendly movie. The director is a great Norwegian director named Andre Overdahl, who did a couple really great movies that I love. One was Troll Hunter a few years ago, and then more recently, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, which is one of the scariest things I've seen.
I love both of those movies.
They're great.
Troll Hunter is great, and The Autopsy of Jane Doe is terrifying.
Yeah.
I watched that at like 2 o'clock in the morning on my couch alone in my apartment, and I had to turn lights on. It was freaking me out. Okay,
well,
guys.
You have no one to blame but yourself.
Exactly. Okay, hang on a second, okay, guys?
Yeah.
All right, we'll find out what Steve thought of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, what Eric thought, and I'll tell you what I thought of it right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Lots of movies to talk about this morning, so we're continuing to do that. We'll also do some box office. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're talking about prison movies, too, and more right here on WGN. Before the break, Steve was telling us about Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, the latest movie. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, so continue, Steve.
Yeah, I was just going to just to wrap it up and say this director has a lot of talent in many realms, but in particular with this film of sort of keeping things just on the right side of graphic and terrifying. That being said, there's one particular monster that's made up of like body parts that separate and come back together and not always in the right way, and the result is like genuinely upsetting sometimes. So, but it's also really fun and. You know, there's this ghastly scarecrow and a severed toe in some food and the end result of a sort of fairly nasty spider bite. It's just like, it's fantastic. And each one gives us just enough to sort of quicken our pulse in a way that feels more like a thrill ride than a kind of endurance challenge where the filmmakers are just sort of testing the limits of blood and guts and taste. So, I'm not sure how scared I was by Scary Stories, but I was really impressed with the craftsmanship of both the creature design and the performances by the young cast and certainly just the period stuff. I wouldn't call Scary Stories a message film, but I also liked that it wasn't afraid to be a little political and features these threads that sort of bring the supernatural in line with the all-too horrors of things like war and Richard Nixon. So despite its slant toward a slightly younger audience, the movie doesn't pander. It doesn't ever feel watered down. It just opts not to get really extreme, and that's fine. Like, we've got plenty of other horror movies this year that will get very extreme, and I'm looking at you, It Chapter 2. But, but as a solid, just like, creep show, and especially one that could be like an entry level thing for younger people who might trend darker at a certain age, I think they're going to get a big kick out of it.
Okay. All right, Eric, what did you think?
Ultimately, I liked it too. I'm a bit more of a softer recommendation on the film, as I was for most of the way I was kind of a middle of the road watching the film. I think the movie has a really solid setup with the characters. It had the kind of autumn like feel. The movie set around Halloween that sort of reminded me a bit of Something Wicked This Way Comes, which I think a movie that I absolutely adore. So I think the setup is great, and I think when it gets into sort of the trying to tell all the different stories, for one, it certainly leans into the body horror aspect, which is something that I definitely was not expecting. And there are parts of those sequences that I like and others that I think are not as greatly tied in. I couldn't figure out while I was watching the movie whether or not it would have been better to play it as an anthology thing, but we all know how anthology movies can tend to have its ups and downs and end up ultimately being unsatisfying. So I didn't mind the way that they were doing it. I just thought that since once they sort of get in the middle act of the movie, I think kind of has that anthology sag a little bit because it doesn't have a whole lot of time to build into the suspense of each particular story that is being written about all these different characters, although the payoff of the Scarecrow thing really almost made me gag in the theater. That really sort of affected me. The red dot thing, you kind of see where the punchline of these things going, with the exception of the hospital sequence, which I think is really quite terrific, what ultimately happens to that character, who unfortunately might as well have been played by Eugenio Debez, because I think that Chuck character is so annoying throughout the movie that every time he said something stupid or goofy or was scared, I was just like, I really hope he goes next. But then I think it kind of picks up again during the final act of the movie, which I think is very nicely done. The creature that Steve mentions that appears in that, the design, the sound design particularly, I think is really strong. And I kind of just, thinking back when I was walking out of the theater, just there are enough effective sequences in the movie and moments that it'd be just kind of disingenuous to not give it some kind of recommendation to people. I think that it's problematic in the middle. I think the script is not particularly good, but I think it's very well directed. A director that I'm not as fond of as you guys are. I think I like the first hour, two-thirds of Autopsy of Jane Doe, and I think it gets very routine in the third act. And I thought this pretty much the same of Troll Hunter, too, although maybe a little bit less so. But this, I think, is the best thing he's done to date. And, it's not a huge recommendation, but I think it tries a lot harder than a lot of horror films of this type have recently. So I am giving it a recommendation.
I loved it. I loved it. I thought it was great. And, there are times because, I'm a horror fanatic. And I sometimes, especially in the mid-2000s, when all of the Japanese PG-13 remakes, were coming out, there was this whole stigma of a PG-13 horror movie that made me kind of crazy. But that's not even the case. This movie's creepy, man. I mean, it earns. I mean, that spider scene is ridiculous, man. And it made me think of The Believers. You guys remember The Believers? Martin Sheen. First thing. That was a hard R, that movie. But I was with this thing all the way through, man. And I want to mention the kids in the movie. I think the kids are great, especially the lead. Is Zoe Margaret Coletti. She's fantastic in this movie and carries the final third pretty much all on her own. It's a very sort of an exhausting performance, and she's really funny and really sweet, and I like the chemistry between her and Michael Garza, who plays Ramon, and I like the other two kids. I didn't find the kid who played Chuck annoying. I liked their relationship, the Augie Chuck relationship. Genuinely creepy stuff. The toe stuff got me. I mean all of that stuff.
That sequence's good too.
Yeah. Oh, it's terrific. I'm never going to eat beef stew again. I know that much. But yeah, and all the creatures are really wonderful. That hospital sequence that you were talking about. That creature, I don't know why it was so creepy, but he's got that smile on his face, or if it's a male, I don't know. But I love the design, and you can see Del Toro's touch on those. You know, especially that last creature, the twisty creature. But it's really scary stuff, and it doesn't hold back just being PG-13. I was surprised that I love the fact that the kids went to go see Night of the Living Dead at the drive-in. That was that was something that I enjoyed, and I just thought that it was very creative, really creepy. And I'm not familiar with the books because I was a little bit older, you know, for they weren't aimed at my. So I'm not familiar with the books. I don't know if it's faithful. All I know is that it's creepy and that the kids were good and the creatures were great and it was scary and suspenseful and I dug it. I thought it was really, really good. Scary stories to tell in the dark. I'm highly recommending it. I think it's a terrific movie. So there you go. All right, next week, what do we got next week? We got Good Boys.
Mm-hmm. Good Boys.
And?
Angry Birds, the movie 2.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well,
and we actually have the new Richard Linklater film that nobody's seen.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Bernadette. Where'd you go?
And a shark sequel.
Oh, yeah. 47 meters down with no cage or whatever the hell.
Uncaged.
Downer.
Yeah. Uncaged. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Byron Allen.
Did you say Further Downer?
Yeah. Further Downer? Is that what that's called?
I think it's a better title.
I think so, too. All right. Steve, we will talk to you next week. Thanks, buddy.
Yes. Thanks.
Okay. All right, Eric, let's jump into the box office here.
All right.
Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Nobbs, Hobbs and Shaw.
Yeah.
25.4 million, 108 million domestically, and you're saying that's underperforming compared to the other Fast Furious movies.
Yeah, totally compared to the other Fast and Furious movies. I mean, but you know, people should point out that Furious 7 and The Fate of the Furious, like, these are two of the highest grossing films of all time, as ridiculous as that sounds. Furious 7 is like top 10 globally, and Fate of the Furious is like 17th.
Crazy.
They're both billion-dollar movies. So, but I think that, you know, it's less that, you know, I joked earlier that Vin Diesel's probably having a good laugh, but I don't think these movies because of Vin Diesel.
Yeah.
So I think that these movies are starting to wane a little bit on the public.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I mean, look, you know, I haven't even seen it yet because I was busy over the weekend, and I like all of them.
Right.
Or most of them. I didn't like the last one very much. But I'm, you know, I look forward to the Fast and Furious movies, and I still have not gone out. So I think that might say something, you know. Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, 20.8 million. That's solid.
It's pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good. So we'll just see if it has the kind of word of mouth it needs to sort of keep it afloat.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, it could be looking at like a $50 million gross. Could be more if the word of mouth hits.
Yeah. It was packed when we went Saturday.
Yeah.
And by the way, my folks loved it. My dad loved it. and they both hated The Kitchen. Number three, The Lion King, 20 million. That's up to 473 million just in America.
Yeah, insane.
Crazy, man. Number four, Dora and the Lost City of Gold, 17 million. Was that as expected?
Not a great number for it. It's kind of on par with actually what Spy Kids 2 did many years ago.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that was 2002. That ended up making like $85 million. This one, you know, again, it's going to need some word of mouth to turn a profit for Paramount.
Okay. Number five, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, $11.6 million, over $100 million. How is this in terms of Tarantino dollars?
Very well.
Yeah.
It's doing very well. Another $100 million film for Tarantino. It's only the second original film of 2019 to gross over $100 million.
What's the first?
Us.
Us. Oh, okay. So original meaning?
No remake, no comic book adaptation, no sequel, that kind of stuff.
Okay. All right. I think we need more of those.
Yep.
Number six, The Art of Racing in the Rain, 8.1 million. That's, you know, considering how popular the book is, that's not good money. That's not good numbers.
No, not really. I don't imagine word of mouth is going to pick up on that one either.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, boy, The Kitchen. Wow. 5.5 million. And the theater was pretty much empty when we went.
Yeah, this is the low. I mean, Happy Time Murders open higher.
Oh!
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, number eight. There we go. Spider-Man still in there. Spider-Man: Far From Home, $5.3 million.
Approaching $1.1 billion.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. So I'm assuming that did better than the Raimi films, right?
It's the first Spider-Man film to hit $1 billion.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Number nine, Toy Story 4. 4.4 million. How's that do compared to the others?
Highest grossing film domestically of the Toy Story series, and it's $10 million away from hitting $1 billion.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good, because it's awesome.
That's right. Happy for that.
And then The Farewell, which is not playing in as many theaters, $2.2 million, $10 million. I was hoping to see bigger numbers for this.
I was to 700 theaters.
I think we're breaking up here, Eric. Are you there, Eric? Eric, I can't hear you. I think we lost Eric. All right, we lost Eric. So, The Farewell, I wanted to see bigger numbers. I know that Tom went to go see it again over the weekend, and I know that's and it's a really terrific movie if you've not seen it. So that's the box office. We'll talk to Eric again next week. So we've got more movies to review next week. We'll do the box office as well. So I want to thank Eric, and I want to thank Steve. We're going to take a break right here on 720 WGN with more after this.